Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, August 28, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will be hosting Dr. John Baker, who will be discussing a warning to corporate counsel about intrusions of state attorneys general, as highlighted with ExxonMobil. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Dr. John Baker is a visiting professor at the Georgetown University Law Center and at Peking University School of Transnational Law, as well as Professor Emeritus at the Louisiana State University Law Center. After Dr. Baker's remarks, we will move to an audience Q&A. For your convenience, please visit the Teleforum webpage to find an article at the very bottom of the website discussing more details about what we will be talking about today. Thank you for speaking with us, Dr. Baker. The floor is now yours.
Thank you, Wesley. You may have seen, if you read the New York Times, that last week on Wednesday and Thursday, there was something about this dispute between the Attorney General of New York and ExxonMobil. And first of all, I want to thank Dean for arranging for the New York Times to accommodate us and promote us by making this issue very much in the public domain again, because to some extent it had receded, at least in the media. So basically, the article that I published, which is mentioned by Wesley, was published back in January or February, but the main article was really completed about a year ago. It was updated after the election a little bit. So what I'm going to do is go through a timeline, but I'm going to begin with really what is the explosion of the issue in the public, and then I'll go back, and then I'll go forward. So I'm going to go through that, and after that, I'm going to hit three basic areas in terms of issues. One is going to be criminal investigation of corporations and others, and two will be certain constitutional issues that it raises, not only speech, but surprisingly, the Compacts Clause. And three, I want to talk generally about the direction of corporations and the way that they are being maneuvered by the left. So to begin with the outline of what's happened, the big event really came last March 29th in a news conference in New York held and led by New York Attorney General Schneiderman, in which he called a news conference and brought in representatives of 18 offices of attorneys general and Al Gore. And the purpose of the conference supposedly was to discuss their investigation into fraud by certain fossil fuel companies. Although Exxon was never specifically named in the conference, it was clear that it was all about Exxon for reasons related to what had preceded the conference. The charges made were heavily about fraud, and the person who made most of the allegations of fraud was Al Gore, which was an interesting thing because we all know that Al Gore is a competitor with his various investments with the fossil fuel industry. So it was most unusual, to say the least, to have a competitor at a news conference about possible legal action against the opposing side. The most amazing thing, I think, about the conference was, there were various statements that were amazing to begin with, but several of them go together. Repeatedly, the Attorney General of New York referred to, quote, vacant moral forces, close quote. This is about the do-nothing Congress, meaning the Republican Congress. And he stated that, quote, this is the beginning of our end to the addiction of fossil fuels, close quote. But the best of all, I think, was the closing one, where he said that we are going to save the planet, and that is ultimately what we are here for. That's a quote. I know that attorneys general have been expanding the scope of their responsibilities, or as they see it, but that really is rather a broad scope of jurisdiction claimed by the New York Attorney General. Going back, this was really all triggered by the environmental movement, and they got Schneiderman to pick it up. In September of 2015, about 2 years ago, Insider Climate News had ran the basic story accusing ExxonMobil of suppressing evidence of climate change. New York Times and later the Columbia Journal of Journalism picked up on this. And in the LA Times article in October of 2015 claimed that Exxon knew that their research was distorting the science. And meanwhile, they were supporting climate change deniers, specifically the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the Heartland Institute. Well, that comes just a month or two later, before Schneiderman starts to issue subpoenas to Exxon. That's in November of 2015. That's when it really came to light that there was indeed a follow-up to these news articles and that Schneiderman had picked it up. After the news conference, various things began to happen. First of all, political, legal, and then media-wise. Politically, all of the then Democratic presidential candidates jumped on board. And a few of the members of Congress wrote letters to DOJ asking for a fraud investigation. DOJ eventually sent it over to the SEC. Later on, Lamar Smith, on the opposite side, the Republican side, he opened up an investigation asking for documents, subpoenaing documents from Schneiderman and requesting that Schneiderman testify. And Schneiderman has certainly ignored the request for testifying. I don't know whether he has complied at all with the document request. On the legal side, ExxonMobil filed their own suit in the Dallas area and against both the New York Attorney General ultimately and the Massachusetts Attorney General. There was also an involvement by the Attorney General in the Virgin Islands. Anyway, ultimately that suit was transferred up to New York, and 12 Republican AGs sided in an amicus brief with Exxon against the New York Attorney General, claiming the New York Attorney General was abusing his power. More recently, Schneiderman has indicated that he may require Secretary of State Tillerson to testify because Tillerson was involved during much of this period. Indeed, it was Tillerson who changed the policy at Exxon and embraced climate change, as it were. So no good deed goes unpunished. Tillerson might have regretted what he did because he's had to go out and hire his own counsel, even while as Secretary of State, to deal with these issues from his past because he's no longer employed by Exxon. On the media front, I just mentioned, but more specifically, on September 23rd last week, there was an op-ed by a professor at Harvard who had done a study. And the important thing about this is that she said that Exxon's scientific studies actually tracked or were in accord with the science at the time, which of course contradicts the initial claims. But she charged that Exxon had misled the public. So in other words, having found out that the facts don't meet the scenario, the story, the narrative that they put forward, they've changed the narrative. Now it's misled the public. They had the science right, but they didn't convey the right science to the public. The Exxon responded, and they responded by quoting some New York Times quotes, noting that the background of this particular professor was very much anti-Exxon. But on that same day, the New York Times weighed in with its own editorial to presumably rebut the letter from Exxon. anyway, that is the kind of timeline to where we are now. As I mentioned, there are several issues that I want to talk about, the first being criminal. The 12 attorneys general are arguing, I think, very persuasively that the New York attorney general is abusing his power. And the press conference itself, to me, is enough evidence of that. Indeed, it's amazing to me that he could get away with what I consider to be very unethical conduct by a state prosecutor. I was a state prosecutor, and we wouldn't have ever and couldn't have ever done anything like that. But we weren't involved in, quote, a noble cause, as I'm sure Schneiderman may see it. Moreover, he really doesn't have to worry that anyone is going to take him up before a bar committee on an ethics violation. Just as a sidebar, it's interesting that when Judge Napolitano made his remarks about the Russians and that tended to support President Trump, there were calls by a number of lawyers in New York to file a bar grievance against him that he was acting or speaking in a fraudulent way. And even though he was on television and not acting as an attorney, he was an attorney and therefore was bound by the standards that would bind somebody in actual litigation. Just a sidebar, but it one that shows how completely distorted the whole debate about abusive power is. But the abusive power is made possible because of the particular statute that is involved, and that is the Martin Act. Now, most of the time when I'm writing or speaking on criminal law, it's to criticize federal criminal law. In this case, however, you recall that Elliot Spitzer was quite aggressive in the way he used New York law to go after corporations, AIG in particular. Well, Schneiderman is continuing in that pathway. What enables Schneiderman to do so is the Martin Act. This is part of what we call blue sky securities laws enacted by the states. But this one is amazingly broad, and it supposedly covers fraud, but its definition of fraud is so loose that any kind of misrepresentation of the most minor kind would seem to fit. And in that context, there is no mens rea requirement, according to the courts in New York, for a violation of the Martin Act. Therefore, investigators for the Attorney General's office in New York have quite a broad scope for pulling corporations in. And what they do, it's clear that they use it as a shakedown. And this is part of the warning to corporations. Right before launching, publicly at least, the investigation against Exxon, Schneiderman settled a case against Peabody Coal. And the pattern in New York is to bring these investigations and settle with monetary settlements out of the corporations. And given the breadth of their power and the expense involved, this has been a quite successful shakedown operation. As Columbia Law School professor John Coffey, an expert, one of the leading experts in securities law, said in reviewing the case at the time, there didn't really seem to be any basis substantively under the Martin Act, nor even under SEC standards. Again, there's more detail on this in the article. The second issue that I mentioned is the constitutional issues. In terms of Exxon's defense, it has focused on free speech. And meanwhile, the response from the New York Attorney General is that, well, free speech doesn't include fraud. So you've got a loose definition of fraud against the claim of constitutional free speech. But we know that almost all the Democratic political office holders and others think that corporations really aren't entitled to free speech. Fortunately for Exxon, Trump won, because had Hillary won, we know that a different Supreme Court would have emerged, and it's quite likely that since their target has been corporate speech, that the Citizens United case would have before long been overturned. And maybe they were counting that on that. I don't know. But at the outset, that was their main argument. Looked possibly that it might be a lost argument, depending on the election. But fortunately, it's now, again, a solid argument. The other dimension of speech, and more broadly, the First Amendment, it just seems very strange for courts to be ruling on what is and is not good science. Science is a matter that has changed over the years, over the decades, over centuries. And for courts to come in and pronounce on science, other than when necessary in a particular case that raises it, seems to me a very dangerous line to go down. The other constitutional issue that I cover is not one that's readily discussed very often because there are so few cases on it. It's the Compacts Clause, which is in Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, third paragraph. And that language says, no state without consent of Congress shall enter into any agreement or compact with another state. Well, that's exactly what's going on here. Schneiderman announced an agreement with all of these other attorneys general. And what's interesting is that the purpose of it was to act in a way counter to what the political branch of the Congress was willing to do in Washington. And they said that very clearly. Now, there are only really two U.S. Supreme Court cases dealing with the Compacts Clause, one from the 19th century, Virginia versus Tennessee, and a 1978 case, U.S. Steel versus Multi-State Tax Commission. These cases allow for compacts among the states if they don't threaten federal issues or interests. I think those cases are wrong to the extent that they hold that. But even if they are correct, they don't cover this situation. In this situation, the agreement is for the purpose of counteracting federal policy or the failure of the feds to adopt the policy that they want. That hasn't seemed to bother them at all. Now, sometimes people raise the argument, well, wait a minute, how is this any different from the Republican AGs who brought suit against Obamacare? Well, there's a big difference. The mechanism created by our Constitution to resolve disputes between states and the federal government is through litigation. We substituted the rule of law and judges, first of all, for war, and secondly, for compacts, which, as we know from the 19th century, led to the Civil War. In any event, some of the Democrats today, AGs, are following on other issues the proper path in the sense that they are litigating against the federal government. That certainly is consistent with federalism, whether you agree with their particular issues or not. But going outside the structure to create an agreement for whatever purpose to oppose federal interests or federal policy is not what was at all contemplated by the Constitution. Specifically, it uses Article 1, Section 10 to try to stop that. The third issue that I'd like to turn to, and really, this is for people who, or corporations or general counsel, who aren't so much concerned about the environmental issue, but about what it means for corporations. We know from the presidency of President Obama that Alinsky tactics were very much on display, one would argue, or at least much talked about. The Alinsky tactics of creating conflict, led various left-wing organizations to use shakedowns or forms of protection in effect, knowing that many corporations, that is public corporations, and I think there is a difference between public corporations and private ones, public corporations are very much subject to pressure. Sometimes the pressure is subtle, in community pressure, seeking donations and corporations justifying it by, quote, being good citizens. They can also justify it on the basis that being a good citizen raises sales and income and therefore is good for the shareholders. And a lot of conservative economists criticize the involvement in corporations in such, quote, charitable work. But it's not all charitable. A lot of it is out-and-out political work. And this is the kind of thing that conservatives traditionally have not done because they believe that corporations, as part of the private sector, ought to be allowed to simply do what they do best, which is to put out a product, sell the product, and generate profits for their stockholders. But I want to give some examples, and I do in the article about this, because when I went to law school, my corporation's law teacher was heavily involved in what was known as campaign GM. Campaign GM is the original granddaddy operation against a corporation. And while GM was very powerful at the time, they were powerful in direct conflicts. And what Ralph Nader and others developed was the side attack, the guerrilla warfare that they were not used to. And ultimately, Nader was successful, and GM did things that caused them to have to pay Nader. But GM, chastened by that and other things, took a different track. I don't know if you realize it, but in the affirmative action cases from Michigan, Gratz and Grutter, the main driver behind the corporate support of that was General Motors. Indeed, the CEO at the time of General Motors went to the other Fortune 500 companies and got them to sign on to briefs supporting the position of the University of Michigan against those who were challenging affirmative action. One of those signatories to it was Exxon. But what happened to GM? Well, we know that the left is not satisfied by simply ultimately giving certain tokens. They want real control. And in the end, GM, which became Government Motors, as we know for a time, they shifted even before that. I was at a Federalist Society conference that was held in 2000 during the summer of that presidential campaign. And it was a conference on federalism. Senator Fred Thompson was one of the co-chairs, but the other co-chair was the general counsel of General Motors. And at that time, the counsel, and I didn't realize that at the time, General Motors was busy supporting the University of Michigan. But when I raised to him questions about criminal law and mens rea and the impact on corporations, he said these concerned him, but they were not, quote, high priority. It was not long after that, in fact, Congress passed the TREAD Act, which in effect criminalized product liability. The corporations have their, public corporations, have their priorities out of whack in some cases. And this is the success that the left has had is only growing. A recent article in one of the law journals, not law reviews, but law journals, was about the cooperation between general counsels and diversity officers. We know that corporations, through their diversity officers, are insisting that major law firms do certain things on affirmative action, satisfy their standards in order to keep their business. The direction is fairly clear if one looks at the panorama from the late 60s to now. And that is, it is not enough to simply satisfy the left on particular issues. They want more than that. And those who have talked about it on the left have said very clearly that what they want is government control, but since they can't get that right away, they want to use shareholder activism, which they're using in the Exxon case, and other methods to de facto get the kind of control they're seeking. Exxon has cooperated in this like other major corporations, and now it's fighting and spending a lot of time and effort to defend its own ability to engage in speech. But look at what other corporations are doing, Facebook and Google. They're engaged, in effect, in trying to suppress speech. This is the direction that the left is trying to get public corporations to go, and some of them are willingly going in that direction, and that's why I raised the alarm that people ought to be paying attention to this, because we are going down that pathway. So I'll stop here and take whatever questions the audience may have.
Thank you, Dr. Baker. Let's move to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter the star key and then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's move to our first audience question.
Hi, Professor. Of course, I under the First Amendment guarantee of free expression. People have every right to lie. And I'm wondering if it's your contention that corporations have the right to lie to their shareholders and to the public. And
no,
they
not
have
at
that
all.
Right. Are you advocating that?
No, not at all. Nothing I said would support that.
Well, to the extent that you're talking about Exxon, needing to defend their right to free speech, and the allegation from the state attorneys general is that Exxon has been lying for many, many years. I'm curious, if they don't have that right to lie, what is wrong with their investigation?
Well, I think I pointed out the problem with the statute. And that is not something new that I've pointed out. I have been writing for years about vague statutes. And the basic requirement of the rule of law is that you have clear statutes in order to inform the public about what they can do and what they can't do. The so-called crime of fraud, there is real fraud, but it has been expanded both by the feds and by, in this case, the Martin Act. There is no indication so far of fraud. And if there is, it should be brought forward. The fact of the matter is that the article or the report about which the op-ed appeared admitted that, in fact, there was no misrepresentation in the science. In terms of the public statements of Exxon, I refer you to John Coffey, it's in the article, quoting him about what they are allowed to do in terms of representing their product. You know, I mean, obviously you sympathize with the Schneiderman approach, and that's fine to sympathize with it, but as a prosecutor, a former prosecutor, where's the evidence? The burden is on the prosecutor to come forward with the evidence.
Thank you, caller, for your question. The queue is open for anyone like to ask a question. Remember, enter the pound key and then the star key, and then the pound key on your telephone to ask a question. Before we get to our next caller, we'd like to let everyone know that our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for Thursday, August 31st at 3 p.m. It'll be an update on the fiduciary rule presented by Jason Mendro. Please keep an eye out for these emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls, and you can always consult the schedule on our website, as well as a list of formerly recorded podcasts of Teleform calls. Also, as a reminder, the article we are referencing is on the website page for this Teleform. Let's move to our next audience question.
Hello, Professor. Thank you very much for your speech. One of the questions I'd like to ask you, it seems to me, and I'd like to know if you agree, there seems to be a little bit of a disturbing trend to this political prosecution of political opponents. And so the first indications of this 6-8 years ago with the prosecution of various Tea Party entities, giving them a hard time with the not-for-profit status. Do you think that this is just a blip that you think will pass, or you think this is a more troubling trend you've seen over the last 10 years?
Well, political prosecutions go back to the beginning of the Republic. That is, the Federalists engaged in them, and then the Jeffersonians engaged in them. Criminal law, by its nature, is political, in quotes, in the sense that it is designed to police the polis, the city. That's what polis means. So there's always that political element. The federal government was not given a general police power for that very reason. It was left to the states. The whole idea in my critique of federal criminal law has been about the abuse so much of federal criminal power. There are abuses at the state level as well, but the difference is the federal government has nationwide jurisdiction. States are limited to their own boundaries normally. In this case, because of the importance of New York, the New York Attorney General has a great deal of jurisdiction. As far as the federal government goes and the Tea Party, the reality is that the power of the federal government has grown over the years when it comes to criminal matters, and you're going to find abuses on both sides as long as there is too much power in this area where it shouldn't be in the first place. There were abuses before the last administration. There were abuses in the Nixon administration. There were abuses before. But you can track the abuses in terms of the rise of not only the number of statutes, federal criminal statutes, but the amount of money put behind criminal enforcement and the focus of where criminal enforcement goes. So I've written a lot about that subject, and it has many dimensions to it. I would not limit it to the last 8 years, though.
Thank you.
Thank you, caller, for your question. The floor is open for any audience questions. Again, just press the star key and then the pound key. While we wait for another audience question, Dr. Baker, just as a comment for the benefit of the audience, is there anything in the upcoming, in the near future, that we should keep an eye on for this issue?
Just watch the New York Times. No, I mean, the litigation is ongoing. I don't keep up with it on a day-to-day basis. Anything that's important is going to come out, not in your local paper, but certainly in the New York Times or in the various publications on environmental news.
Thank you. Let's move to our next audience question.
Hello, Mary Maxwell here in Alabama. Thank you so much for saying that about federal criminal power. Do you have any suggestions on how to turn this around? I mean, the trend toward greater power.
Well, the problem is that Republican attorneys general come in with law and order programs often. Certainly Attorney General Sessions, a former U.S. attorney, has that as one of his major points. There's an important role of federal criminal law to deal with those issues that the states can't deal with. In the age of the internet and identity fraud, which only the federal government can deal with, it's very important that they put their resources there. In terms of terrorism, in terms of international crimes, there's more than enough for the federal government to do. The difficulty is that often what federal prosecutors focus on are matters really that fall under state jurisdiction.
Can you think of a challenge that has already occurred on the, you know, the federal grab of power beyond its constitutional basis?
Well, this has been ongoing for many years. In the 1990s, the Supreme Court addressed it in two cases, the Lopez case and the Morrison case.
Yes.
But Congress completely ignored the court's statements about the lack of its power. That doesn't bother Congress, Republicans or Democrats, when they want to do something.
I think Clarence Thomas said he was going to revisit the matter. Well, if that was 1995, 22 years ago.
I couldn't make out completely what you just said.
I don't remember if it was Morrison or Lopez, but Justice Clarence Thomas said we need to think about this expansion of the Commerce Clause, but he really meant his branch needs to think about it, and you're just saying,
right?
Yeah.
Right.
Wow, this is terrible.
Well, I think the new Justice Gorsuch, has made some statements about this as well, and so maybe there will be more of a change of direction. Let's hope.
Yes, thank you.
Derek, thank you very much for your question, caller. The floor is open. Again, just press the star key and then the pound key on the telephone keypad.
Professor Baker, Tom Getty here. Thank you very much,
Tom,
for doing this. And can you address a little of when the attorneys general also exact injunctive relief in addition to fines and penalties when they use these settlements, and how that is sort of legislating through the settlement process?
Tom, you're as qualified as I am to talk about that. But in terms of injunction, if they can get the result they want, it's not necessarily that they need the money. They want to change behavior. And an injunction is certainly not only a very good way, probably the best way to do it. I don't know what more you have in mind on that. And you may have personal experience when you were in the California AG's office.
Yeah, it's a troubling thing, but using the securities laws of a state and then imposing additional restrictions on the behavior of a corporation that is unlegislated strikes me as fairly dangerous.
Well, it's not only that, it's also on speech. There is a provision I learned recently, and you may already know about it, that if you settle with the SEC, there is a provision that says you can't deny your conduct later on. And so I know somebody who had a book written already but didn't publish it when he realized that he might have the whole thing unravel if he said anything critical of the SEC and how they handled the case.
Pretty frightening. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, caller, for your question. We still have several more minutes. If anyone would like to ask a question, the floor is open. Remember, press the star key and then the pound key.
Hello, it's me again from Alabama. Now I'm asking, based on that question about injunction, is there any action through declaratory relief on the matter of the federal criminalization grab?
Well, we have the declaratory judgment, but I don't know how you would. The problem is when someone is indicted, you can't, well, at least at the state level, you can't go into federal court after an indictment and get a federal declaration or injunction against it. It's under what we call our federalism. In terms of federal court, when you're indicted in federal court, you're in federal court. And what you do is you make motions to try to get the case dismissed. The reality is that it's safer for federal district judges to rule for the government, because if they rule for the government 95% of the time or more, the defendant will end up pleading. If he pleads, there's nothing to appeal. District judges, state and federal, do not want to be reversed. And the reality is that as a defendant, when you lose a motion, except in rare cases, you can't take that motion up. You have to wait till the case is over. So you asked about reforms before. One of the things that I would do is to make it easier for defendants in federal court to take up motions challenging the constitutionality of the statute or the application by the Department of Justice, so that they don't have to go through the whole litigation process before being able to challenge it on appeal.
But you really think the selfish behavior of the attorneys is what's guiding
them? No, it's much more complicated than that. I mean, attorneys have to do, in defending their client, they have to do what's in the best interest of the client at the time.
Yeah.
And, representing a client, it's not necessarily in the best interest of the client to engage in much broader constitutional attacks, unless it's helpful to the client. And there's a tension there, you know.
Yes, where's the right of the citizen who's not in that case, not involved in the case, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, what you're saying is, could there not be an action to bring a declaratory judgment that certain statutes are in some way vague. The problem is, and again, we're getting far afield here from the topic, but it has to do with the ability to bring an action under vagueness or overbreadth and standing issues, and it's just beyond the scope of this. So thank you for your question, but I really can't.
Yes, it was okay. A marvelous answer. Thank you. Bye.
I know.
Thank you, caller, for your question. The floor is open. If anyone would like to ask a last question, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. Seeing no immediate questions, Dr. Baker, do you have any closing remarks?
No, not really. I thank you and Dean for setting this up for me, and happy to do it for you.
Well, Dr. Baker, on behalf of the Federal Society, I would like to thank you for your benefits of your valuable time and expertise today. For our audience, thank you for your questions, and we welcome all feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us today. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.